actually painting the cover guy. Okay. I'll explain it later. Painting the cover guy, art and understanding from a Quinean perspective. As I stepped out of the train at the Westbahnhof yesterday morning, I noticed two serious-looking gentlemen. One of them had a large and bristling moustache, and the other wore horn-rimmed spectacles with rather thick glasses. Both of them were smoking a pipe, and thus I knew them to be philosophers. Both of them were also very red in the face, and the bespectacled gent had grabbed the other by the collar. "Is," he shouted. "Isn't," thundered his opponent, pushing him. "Is, isn't." The moustached one punched the other in the nose, and the other repaid the compliment, and before long they were lost in a whirl of fists and feet, shouting "is" and "isn't" all the while, and a police officer arrived on the scene. Things were threatening to get ugly. I quickly pulled the pugilists apart and asked them if they couldn't settle their grievances like gentlemen. They saw reason, and we swept past the disappointed policeman to repair to a small cafe where, having duly refreshed ourselves, we started to talk. Okay, I will talk slower from now on. This is the non-technical bit, so that's why I was rushing through it. I have a lot of paper to get through. And I will now talk slower. Okay, that's very good, because now is actually the point where the real thing starts. It turned out that the subject of the unfortunate discussion had been the relevance of Quine's theory of radical translation for the philosophy of intercultural communication. I was surprised by such a display of passion concerning a technical philosophical matter at first, for I soon recalled that I was now in Wien, the home of the famous Wiener Kreis, which brought forth Carnap, who was to influence Quine, Goodman, and thinkers of such ilk after moving to the US. Philosophy, not least of all analytical philosophy, had always been an important item here. "Well," said I, "what exactly seems to be the problem?" The mustachioed gentleman spoke first. "The problem is that this ruffian," he indicated his opponent, "seems intent on maintaining that analytical philosophy, which amounts to nothing but pushing around commas and drooling over the apparent factuality of chemistry, physics, mathematics and the like, can actually be useful in the understanding of complex matters such as cultures, artworks, or even human beings." "But it can," replied the bespectacled one. "Analytical philosophy is all about language, and hence about communication. And whoever speaks about interculturality must surely speak about communication. Take a look at Quine's theory of radical translation, for instance." "I shall do no such thing," bellowed the man with the moustache. I immediately berated him for being narrow-minded and pointed out that narrow-mindedness had certainly never been useful in the understanding of complex matters such as cultures. "All right," said the gentleman, "let's hear this wonderful theory. We shall soon see what it amounts to." We all sat back, ordered another round of drinks, and the philosopher with the spectacles happily started to explain Quine's theory of the indeterminacy of translation. Quine tries to account for translation from a behavioristic point of view. He refuses to admit any unobservable, intrasubjective process or entity as an explanation for anything. That means he is not left with much. But even so, he cannot get away from making at least one assumption: that all men are equipped with the same sensorial apparatus, or at least that they are all affected by the same stimuli. He does not explain this notion of stimuli other than by calling them nerve hits or surface irritations. From this, I assume, we may infer that he means all and only those perceptions which we tend to attribute to an outside world. And we may also infer that he presupposes the existence of such an outside whence these perceptions originate. Notice, for it is very important, that we don't perceive objects. What we perceive are colors, shapes, sounds, etc. We combine these into objects ourselves, though we're not usually aware of this. That there are objects is nothing but a theory, albeit one that has become second nature to us. This theory is contained within our everyday language. We tend to speak of tables, chairs, pens, etc., but we do not perceive them. We perceive a bundle of stimuli, which we then organize into a theoretical construct we call a table, a chair, a pen, etc. When we say, I see a table, we have no reason to say anything else than a stimulus occurs that I consider to be so much like other stimuli that I find I have a reason to assume that there is something that causes all these stimuli and I decide to call this thing table. Of course, that's rather long, so we just say I see a table. In fact, we say this so often that we tend to forget the longer sentence and start believing in tables. And now assume that a linguist visited a foreign tribe without knowing their language. How would he learn to speak it if he had no access to an interpreter? He has only got one thing to work with. He can perceive the verbal and non-verbal behavior of the natives. He has to experiment with the sentences he hears around him to formulate a set of working hypotheses about their meanings. For example, let's say he often hears them use the word gavagai, or rather the sentence gavagai, whilst at the same time perceiving a rabbit. He may arrive at the hypothesis that gavagai is their term for rabbit, and then start testing his hypothesis by pointing to rabbits and asking gavagai. If he then gets affirmative answers, he will have to test the hypothesis further by pointing to things that are obviously not rabbits and asking gavagai again. For if he pointed at a duck and got an affirmative answer, not much would be left of his hypothesis. And even if his hypothesis is correct, he does not know what the meaning of gavagai is. He only knows when to use the word. He also knows what English sentence is used for the same stimuli, namely the sentence rabbit. The two sentences are what Quine calls stimulus synonymous. They have the same stimulus meanings, that is, the same set of stimuli will trigger their use and the same set of stimuli will forbid it. Sentences thus linked to our stimuli are called observation sentences, and by finding their stimulus synonyms in English, the linguist can translate them more or less correctly. And luckily, there is more. Truth functions too can be translated. Truth functions are logical connectives like and, or, not, and if. How can we translate those? First of all, we have to make a certain assumption. We have to assume that the behavior, for a start, the verbal behavior of the natives, makes some kind of sense. That it is, in effect, to a certain extent, rational. Otherwise, trying to translate would be a pointless exercise, and one doomed to fail from the very start. If we do not assume that there is some kind of system underlying the other's language, we cannot assume that translation is possible. This may be called the principle of charity. Once we have made this assumption, the interlingual validity of logical connectives almost immediately follows. For if the linguist finds a word that can be used to connect two sentences, and if the sentence thus constructed evokes affirmation if and only if the two original sentences evoked affirmation, then he can either conclude that he has found the word that should be translated as yes, or as and, a conjunctive, or that something very weird is going on. The latter possibility being ruled out by the principle of charity, he will have to admit to the former, and this reasoning holds mutatis mutandis for other logical connectives. And there is something else that the linguist can find out about this foreign language. There are some sentences that are affirmed in the face of any stimulus. We cannot know their stimulus meanings, but we can know one thing, that they are always affirmed. 2 and 2 makes 4 is a good example of such a sentence. Quine calls these sentences stimulus analytic, adding that there is, of course, a great difference between stimulus analyticity and normal analyticity. Sentences like birds sometimes sit in trees, there have been black dogs, or in some circumstances there is a god, will evoke an affirmative response in any situation and are therefore stimulus analytic. But we wouldn't call them analytic in the traditional sense of the word. There are now 3 things that the linguist can do. 1, he can find stimulus meanings for observation sentences. 2, he can translate their truth functions or logical connectives into ours. 3, he can find out which sentences are stimulus analytic, though of course he can never find a stimulus meaning for them, so he cannot translate them. This would probably cover only a relatively small part of any language. How can the linguists draw up a translation manual to translate the entire foreign language into English? There's only one way. He will have to make a large set of hypotheses as to how the sentences whose stimulus meaning he has found are to be divided up in words, and how these words may be connected to make sentences again. As long as these hypotheses preserve all stimulus meanings he has found, and preserves as much stimulus analyticity as he has discovered, there can be no proof as to whether they are right or not. For this reason, Quine calls them analytical hypotheses. The important thing is to realize that different sets of hypotheses can predict the same verbal behavior, and that there is no way of choosing between these sets, apart from considerations of characteristics like simplicity. To see how this might be so, think again of the native sentence gavagai, which has the same stimulus meaning as our rabbit. We do not know how the natives combine the stimuli. They may, like us, combine them into a single individual object, a rabbit, and then gavagai would simply mean rabbit. But they may also combine the stimuli into a recurring universal, let's say, rabbithood. And then gavagai may be more correctly translated into instance of rabbithood. There's no deciding between these two, or even other sets of analytical hypotheses, and this is what Quine calls the indeterminacy of translation. The bespectacled gent sipped his coffee with evident satisfaction. So there. Well, said the mustachioed philosopher, all this is very nice, no doubt, but I still hardly see the relevance for intercultural philosophy. The man with the spectacles frowned in a sad sort of way. I decided to come to the rescue. In the first place, I said, Quine gives us a theory of translation that can be reconciled to relativism. This is of no small significance, as translation does put the relativist in a problematic position. After all, the relativist assumes that people from different cultures, different paradigms, perceive different things, perceive different worlds. And it's hard to see how translation can take place if the source language and the target language describe different universes. Quine, however, removes these difficulties by giving an account of translation that does not rely on the description of a universe, but instead hinges on the disposition to respond to stimulations. And most relativists will willingly grant that stimulations are not paradigm dependent. So that's got that taken care of. Yes, said the mustachioed gentleman, I'll concede that Quine's bit of analytical philosophy is an argument against the argument of translation, which of course is another bit of analytical philosophy, so I still don't... The bespectacled man cut him short. There is another matter, and that's relevant in its own right, regardless of any discussions between relativists and rationalists, and I'm talking about the principle of charity. We've already heard it. The what? The principle of charity. I've already mentioned it, you know. The principle guaranteed us that we could translate truth functions. For it means that we must assume that the person speaking the target language are to a large extent reasonable.
Excuse me, slow down a bit again.
I will slow down again, okay. Thank you for pointing it out. If I'm going too fast or become too technical, please shout. Okay, we were talking about the principle of charity. The principle of charity means that we must assume that the people speaking the target language are, to a large extent, reasonable. So that's meaning A of the principle of charity that Professor Longato pointed out. If the linguist were to ascribe inexplicable, irrational beliefs to the natives, he could no longer claim to be correctly translating. After all, what grounds could he give for his claim? If he does not mold his analytical hypotheses into a rational system with a large degree of internal consistency, then everything is permitted, logically. He may decide to translate the sentence gavagai, which has the same stimulus meaning as rabbit, into elephant, and account for the absurdity of this by pointing to the pre-logicality or irrationality of the natives. But he has no reason to choose elephant as a translation rather than, say, duck, heat-seeking missile or negotiation. Each of these translations would be equally irrational, so there is no reason to choose one translation over another. And what is a translation manual, if not a set of implicit reasons to choose some translations over others? All right," said the man with the moustache. "I see how a principle of charity might be important to all intercultural philosophy. But I get the feeling that we're deriving an ought from an is here. After all, we only need to be charitable if we claim to be correctly translating. As soon as we drop that claim, there's no longer any need for charity. Apart, of course," I butted in, "from the fact that we need to claim to have correctly translated the natives' utterances, if we want to lend our imputations of pre-logicality any credibility. We can only claim knowledge of the natives' worldview if we claim to have translated his language, and we can only claim to translate if we assume his rationality." "You've got me there," said the moustache gent. "Pre-logicality is right out. So, with the help of Quine, you've successfully kicked that dead dog. I mean, even Levi Bruhl himself gave up his theory of pre-logicality, though not on the grounds just cited." "Well, there's still more," said the philosopher in the glasses. "You see, Quine has written a lot about science too, and anthropology certainly is or claims to be a science. There are thinkers, such as Robert Fallapa, who try to settle methodological discussions in anthropology, such as that between ethicists and emicists, by appealing to Quine's ideas and even drawing on the theory of indeterminacy of translation again. He looked perfectly willing to explain the ethics-emics discussion, but it was a weak bit and he knew it. For the moustached one would immediately reply that he was not interested in the methods of our own science. He was interested in understanding people from a different culture. He might perhaps concede that before he could do that, he first had to determine the best way to do it, but I strongly doubted if he would be willing to seek for the best way to determine the best way to do it. So I decided to cut him short. Why not try a more direct approach?" I asked. Both gentlemen eyed me suspiciously. "We might try to use Quine's theory to understand our own science, but might we not also use his method to understand the symbols we find in another culture? Quine himself tries out the thought experiment of radical translation on language. But language isn't all there is to a culture. Visual art, that is, the creation and apprehension of pictures, plays a role in many cultures too. And as my own favorite philosopher, Nelson Goodman, writes, quote, for a 5th dynasty Egyptian, the straightforward way of representing something is not the same as for an 18th century Japanese, and neither way is the same as for an early 20th century Englishman. Each would, to some extent, have to learn how to read a picture in either of the other styles, unquote. Well then, let's see if we can use Quine's method to determine to what extent one might learn to read a picture from another culture. In other words, we shall try to find out whether pictures have stimulus meanings. This was a proposal the bespectacled gent was very happy with. Knowing that I favored Goodman, a close colleague and friend of Quine's, he figured I was entirely on his side. We will assume, I commenced, that a linguist reaches a community whose way of representing things is unknown to him. We will further assume that he has no guide or interpreter who is familiar with the pictorial system. Lastly, we will diverge from Quine in assuming that this linguist is deaf and mute. On second thoughts, let's not call him a linguist. A deaf-mute linguist would be a strange duck indeed. So let's call him an anthropologist. It's a bit of a cruel assumption, but if our anthropologist were able to speak, he might be tempted to learn the language first and then try to understand the pictures by talking about them. This would probably be the easiest way to acquaint oneself with a foreign way of pictorially representing things, but it would be useless for our purposes, because the anthropologist would then have formed a whole set of analytical hypotheses in having learned the language, and he would, by using language, be using these hypotheses to learn about the pictures. The basic and most problematic step in the process would thus have been taken beforehand. To put it more simply, our anthropologist would just be matching pictures in the system that he's trying to learn to words in the language that he has already learned, instead of trying to match the pictures to situations, or more accurately, stimulations. For that is what our deaf-mute anthropologist, following in the footsteps of Quine's linguist, would have to do. Just as Quine's linguist tries to discover which phrases have stimulus meanings, so our anthropologist would have to find out which pictures, if any, have stimulus meanings. Then he can start to match pictures from this class to particular stimulus meanings. Quine's linguist goes on from this point to identify truth functions and then to find phrases that are stimulus synonymous and finally to draw up analytical hypotheses about the phrases that do not have stimulus meanings. But before we think about allowing our anthropologist to walk a similar path, we should take a look at the first step. Yes, we should, the mustachioed man maliciously said. We should indeed, for if I understand you correctly, the anthropologist should wait until the native produces a picture of his own accord, just as Quine's linguist should allow his native the initiative, instead of putting words in his mouth. And here we run into the first problem. For not always are pictures produced in the presence of a stimulus. A painter putting up his easel in a field to paint the crows he sees there is a phenomenon belonging to a particular phase of our Western culture, and it's not obvious that this behavior must occur in other cultures. For instance, an 18th century Japanese painter may well have the habit to meditate on a scene of nature for days and then go home to paint it. And an artist who decorates a temple can hardly be expected to carry an entire wall around with him until he finds a suitable crocodile to depict. Many pictures, then, are not elicited by stimuli. Our anthropologist may well find himself in a culture where no picture is ever created in the presence of the thing it represents, and in that case, it seems he would be stranded before being able to take the very first step. The bespectacled gent was not going to give up so easily. "Things are not so bad," he said genially. "Quine, for instance, allows his linguist to, quote, supply native sentences for his informant's approval, despite the risk of slanting the data by suggestion," unquote. In fact, the linguist had to do this thing in order to find out whether Gavagai is only uttered in the presence of rabbits, or in the presence of white things, or in the presence of animals. And if Quine's linguist is allowed to supply native sentences, then our anthropologist should be allowed to supply native pictures. Not so fast, I mused. One might say that the case of the linguist is fundamentally different from our anthropologist's position. After all, the linguist can only supply native sentences that he has already heard. He will only put the sentence Gavagai up for approval if he has already heard his informant say Gavagai often enough to be reasonably sure about its being a sentence. And the informant will usually have uttered this sentence in the presence of stimuli that triggered it. Thus, the linguist can only offer sentences whose stimulus meaning he already has some vague hypothesis about, based on his informant's previous behavior. And if our anthropologist finds himself in a community where, for example, pictures are only found in temples, he will have no such behavior to rely on, but he, of course, has something else. Pictures tend to look like the stimuli they represent. Looking like is, of course, a culturally defined relationship, if only because a picture always looks more like another picture than like the thing it denotes. So it would not be easy for our anthropologist to discern rabbit pictures from elephant pictures or even from abstract line drawings. But however difficult this may be, it's still a lot easier than discerning verbal rabbit descriptions from elephant descriptions or from words that describe emotions. So while Quine's linguist will have the advantage of the informant's behavior, Our anthropologist will have visual clues that do count for something. All right, said the man with the moustache, I'll grant you that, but, and his eyes twinkled. This allows him to run into his next problem. How can he test his hypotheses? The linguist has an easy time of it. He can, upon seeing a rabbit, just say the sentence that he thinks may elicit a yes or no response. But our anthropologist can hardly, when spotting a rabbit, start creating a picture. Especially not if, in the informant's culture, pictures are only found in temples. Then he would have to build a temple first. But even with a suitable temple close by, he could not go and paint a picture. For he would not be certain that he was creating a picture that might be said to be part of the informant's symbol system. He might unwittingly be introducing a new way of representing that showed enough resemblances to the native symbol system to elicit a yes or no response, without actually fitting into that symbol system. Let's, to clarify this point, assume that the anthropologist has formed the hypothesis that a certain painting denotes a rabbit. We shall call this painting a Gavagai painting. Now, upon spotting a white rabbit in the presence of a native informant, he quickly grabs a brush and some white paint and creates a Gavagai painting. If his hypothesis was correct, he may elicit a yes response from his informant, even if, in the symbol system under investigation, Gavagai pictures are never done in white. The informant, recognizing the shape of the painting, may confirm the hypothesis, although he wonders at the strange use of color. He may even like what he sees and start up a fashion of experimentation with color, and then the anthropologist would have changed the symbol system he tried to understand. We all sat musing on this for a while. The bespectacled man started to say, yes, but the linguist, I didn't let him finish, for instead of an argument, I had thought of a practical solution, and those are always preferable. I take it, I said to the moustached one, that your point here is that the anthropologist has no way of knowing which properties of a picture are culturally determined as being significant and which are not. Correct? Well, to be on the safe side, our anthropologist has simply got to prepare those pictures he has formed hypotheses about in advance. He's got to make the most exact copies of them that he's capable of, using only the materials the natives themselves use. Then carrying his paintings, drawings or carvings, in or on stones, pieces of parchment, papyrus, wood, paper or whatever with him, he has to go out and show them to his informant in the presence of the relevant stimuli. That would do the trick, said the man in the glasses. And after that, just like the linguist, he can do nothing but hope for the ascent or descent of his informant. Come to think of it, some interesting differences with Quine's linguist arise at this point. Let's see how exactly he is supposed to handle the question of ascent and descent. He took his copy of Word and Object out of his pocket, for he always carried it around with him, and started to quote. How is the linguist to recognize native ascent and descent when he sees or hears them? Gestures are not to be taken at face value. The Turks are nearly the reverse of our own. What he must do is guess from observation and see how well his guesses work. The suppose that in asking Gavagai and the like, in the conspicuous presence of rabbits and the like, he has elicited the response Avet and Yok often enough to surmise that they may correspond to yes and no, but has no notion which is which. Then he tries the experiment of echoing the native's own volunteered pronouncements. If he thereby pretty regularly elicits Avet rather than Yok, he is encouraged to take Avet as yes. Also, he tries responding with Avet and Yok to the native's remarks. The one that is the more serene in its effect is the better candidate. Yes, unquote. I think I see what you mean by differences, said the sage in the moustache. A first and obvious difference between this picture, this procedure, and any procedure that our anthropologist might follow seems to be that whereas the linguist asks verbal questions and gets verbal responses, the anthropologist asks questions by using pictures and is likely to get responses that consist out of gestures. A pictorial symbol system is not a language, and it is hard to conceive of pictures that are equivalent to a yes or no response. This would mean that the media of question and answer are different in the case of our anthropologist, but not of Quine's linguist. "Quite so," I said soothingly, "but this difference dissolves when we take a closer look. For we have already decided that our anthropologist should carry a large amount of pre-prepared pictures along with him. Taking a certain picture out of his bag and showing it to the native can certainly be construed as a gesture. This means that the anthropologist asks by means of gestures, and as he also gets his answer by means of gestures, no different media are used. But another and more important difference between the linguist and the anthropologist arises immediately. For whereas the linguist uses the symbol system that he wishes to translate, language, the anthropologist can't make use of the symbol system he wishes to translate, pictures. He has to use a different one instead, gestures. This puts the anthropologist's venture on a far less solid basis than the linguist one." "Oh, rather," said the mustachioed man, not entirely free of schadenfreude. "And when we take a closer look at the methods of the linguist, we will notice some weak points there as well. For instance, Quine writes about him asking Gavagai and the like. This, however, is not quite possible. For the linguist has no idea yet what constitutes a question in the target language. In English, one raises one's pitch at the end of a question sentence, Gavagai. But in the target language, that may not be the case. Raising pitch may mean nothing at all there, or even something different. What if raising the pitch at the end of a sentence would mean, for instance, negation? Then the linguist would be saying, not Gavagai, whenever he thought he was asking Gavagai, and this behavior would probably give him a rather garbled idea about what meant yes or no. Nor does echoing the native's own volunteered pronouncements offer any real opportunity. For sounds that are very different to the ear of the native may be indistinguishable to the linguist. Think, for instance, of the Japanese, who as a rule don't hear the difference between la and ra sounds. Thus, there is always the possibility of an unperceived difference in sound that makes a noticeable difference in meaning. Echoing the native's pronouncements turns out to be a hazardous procedure. Of course, there are mechanical ways of exactly imitating an utterance, using a tape recorder, for instance. But though tape recording an utterance and then playing it back to the native would eliminate any cultural disposition to notice or ignore differences in sound, having a machine play back the informant's own voice will hardly be perceived as offering a hypothesis, such as the hypothesis that rabbit is a Gavagai, and is therefore very unlikely to get a yes or no response. And the last resort of the linguist is answering the native's questions with Evert and Jok, his candidate for yes and no. And Quine says, quote, "the one that is the most serene in its effect is the better candidate for yes." Now, what might Quine mean here by serene in its effect? He can hardly mean a serene facial expression or a serene tone of voice. That, of course, would be taking gestures at face value, with a vengeance. A method that Quine has decreed against half a paragraph before proposing it. It would also be a method that mixes media in very much the same way that our poor anthropologists' methods do. Perhaps serenity should be taken to refer to behavior on a larger scale than just facial expression. An attack would then be an unserene effect, and an embrace or donation of gifts a serene effect. The difference between having a rock thrown at your head or being given a mango is cross-culturally valid, though provoking actions of this kind might take more than simply saying Evert or Jok to a question. The difficulties in this method are immediately apparent, even apart from the fact that it would still be a case of mixing media. The phrase about serenity remains puzzling. Now, unfortunately, and here the moustache adopted a most malicious grin, This comparison between the linguist and the anthropologist has, instead of giving the anthropologist a stronger foothold, weakened the position of the linguist. That he succeeds at all in coming up with candidates for yes and no is nothing short of a small miracle. I could do nothing but agree. I even had to add, in all honesty, all the more so if we try to imagine Quine's linguist at work, even if the informant has guessed the linguist's goal, which is pronouncing hypotheses of the "that's a rabbit" variety, then he need not be aware that it is vitally important that he answer with the same word for yes every time. In English, there are numerous ways of saying yes. Yes, yep, right, spot on, correct, indeed, etc. Other languages need not differ in this respect. This might complicate the proceedings. And it could even be worse. A language may have a word that can mean both yes or no. Am I going too fast?
I have to go for a second.
Oh.
My problem.
I'm going too slow.
It's too late.
Okay, a language may have a word that can mean both yes and no, depending on the facial expression of the informer, inflection, pitch, gender of the linguist, etc. In a worst-case scenario, a language may have many words meaning yes, some of which can also mean no or maybe, depending on non-verbal circumstances. These possibilities make the first step in the linguist's method very, very difficult. If the linguist is allowed, as Quine allows him, to assume tacitly that there is one word for yes and one other word for no in the target language, then his task is relatively easy, as long as he's lucky and his informant does, in fact, use only one word for yes and one other word for no. If he's got no such luck, or if he's not allowed such assumptions, then he might as well forget recognizing native assent and dissent, and hence the entire value of translation. Unless we allow him to take gestures at face value. This could not give him conclusive evidence, but he can use all the extra clues he can get. Especially the interpretation of gestures may put him on a false track. But it's hard to see how, without it, he could set out on any track at all. The upshot of all this seems to be that the difference we at first perceived between our linguists, Quine's linguist and our anthropologist, is not nearly as large as we assumed. There are, of course, other differences between their methods of recognizing assent and dissent. For instance, our anthropologist carries a large bag of pictures around with him, but the native presumably doesn't. So, in the anthropologist's case, there's no way for the native to volunteer pronouncements of his own. And he still has no pictorial equivalent to Evet and Jok. These differences, however, dissolve together with the first one. For instead of using pictorial equivalents to Evet and Jok, our anthropologist is now allowed to make do with gestures signifying assent or dissent. He's even allowed to use gestures to invite his informant to take pictures out of his own bag whenever he feels like it. If we take this as an equivalent to volunteered pronouncements, the anthropologist is far better able to echo them than the linguist is. "Oh, all right," said the bespectacled man. "So now we have a way for the anthropologist to determine assent and dissent. Isn't it time to start looking at the possibilities for determining the stimulus meaning, if any, of pictures?" The moustache and me both nodded. It was about time. Our friend continued. "A term has both an affirmative and a negative stimulus meaning. Its affirmative stimulus meaning is the class of stimulations that would prompt a given speaker's assent, a yes response. And its negative stimulus meaning is the class of stimulations that would prompt the speaker's dissent, a no response. Its stimulus meaning is the ordered pair of the negative and positive stimulus meanings." Now, our anthropologist, after having determined the gestures for assent and dissent, must take the picture whose meaning he wishes to determine and a native informant to a place where the relevant stimulations are likely to occur. So if he's got a Gavagai picture that he suspects of representing a rabbit, he should take it to a place where rabbits are likely to be spotted. Whenever a rabbit shows himself, for itself. The anthropologist should take out his Gavagai picture quickly and present it to the native for assent or dissent. He should also take it out in the presence of other animals, other brown things, other things with long ears, etc. And when the native gives his assent in the presence of rabbits and dissents at all other times, then the Gavagai picture does have a stimulus meaning, and it's roughly the same as that of our word rabbit. He was interrupted by the mustachioed man. All this is well and good in a culture where pictures have large, what Goodman calls, compliance classes, that is, where one picture may refer to many different objects. For a picture with a large compliance class, we may think of the picture of a male peregrine falcon in an ornithologist's book. Such a picture purports to refer to all male peregrine falcons. A self-portrait by Rembrandt, on the other hand, has a much smaller compliance class. It refers only to the painter himself. And a Mondrian painting has no compliance at all. Its compliance class is void. The reason for these differences is immediately obvious. The pictures have different uses. The paintings by Mondrian and Rembrandt serve to express artistic or aesthetic ideas, whereas the picture in the birdwatcher's book helps us recognize a certain kind of bird. I will not jump to conclusions about any causal connections between the purpose of pictures and the size of their compliance class, for there are more pressing matters at hand, the predicament of our poor anthropologist. He may find himself in a culture where no picture has any compliance class. Think, for instance, of cultures where the producing of images is strictly forbidden, such as those we encounter in certain Islamic societies. In these societies, paintings may still be produced, but they may be purely abstract. Some of these abstract paintings may have hard-to-fathom compliance classes. Think, for instance, of a calligraphic rendering of the local word for rabbit. This painting is not a Gavagai picture, but it will elicit a yes response every time the anthropologist takes it out of his bag in the presence of a visible rabbit. It's hardly likely the anthropologist, not knowing the local language, let alone the local script, will ever guess the compliance class of this picture, but it does have a stimulus meaning. There may also, however, be paintings that have no compliance at all, and these paintings will never elicit a yes response, or they will elicit a yes response every time. These paintings have no stimulus meaning because the stimulation present makes no difference to the response they elicit. By the light in my eyes, he must have seen that I had a couple of remarks to make that I myself found very interesting, but he silenced me with a gesture. Please make your point later, sir. I haven't quite finished, for in yet another culture, there may be paintings that are instantly recognizable as rabbits, but never elicit a yes response. These might be portrayings of individual rabbits, or renderings of historically famous rabbits, or a kind of mythological rabbit god. Show a native these paintings, and whether a rabbit is visible or not, you will get a no response, for the painting does not depict the rabbit present, but another individual rabbit. So if, and only if, the pictographic system our anthropologist is trying to understand is used to refer to classes of objects, then pictures in it will have a stimulus meaning. I smiled and said, "I disagree." The mustachioed man raised his eyebrows, and the bespectacled gent, looking dejected, murmured, "Well, I for one can't find fault with his reasoning." But I explained, "Let's assume our anthropologist reaches a culture where abstract paintings are held in high esteem. There he might find a painting which, unbeknownst to him, is famous among the locals for being such a beautiful expression of the feelings of sadness and loss that are part of the process of mourning. Then almost every informant would give a yes response when confronted with that painting at a funeral. And in a beautiful flowery meadow in spring, they would almost always give a no response. This would mean that this abstract painting does have a stimulus meaning." "Wait a second," the bespectacled man murmured, with a slight panic in his eyes. That can't be right. And he started to leaf through his copy of Word and Object. Well, said the mustachioed philosopher enthusiastically, it certainly doesn't seem wrong. We might find analogous cases with words. If the natives would have a sentence, let's say, Barutho, roughly equivalent to our word, sad, they might all assent to that sentence in the presence of a mother with a dead baby, and dissent in the presence of a birthday party. Especially if the group speaking the language is relatively small and homogeneous, for then they would be likely to be roughly equivalent in their evaluation of situations. Why, yes, I added, and sad in this case is a metaphor, for these situations are not labouring under the emotion we call sadness. The label sadness is metaphorically applied to them. So metaphors and abstract paintings can have stimulus meanings. At least they very easily can in a language that is spoken by a small and homogeneous group of people. Unless I'm very much mistaken, the notion of stimulus meaning seems to depend for a certain part on extra-lingual factors, such as the number of native speakers. But that's not at all what Quine intended, wailed the spectacled man. It may not be what he intended, but it's what he ended up with, the mustachioed man said pompously. Well, sir, I must confess I'm not very impressed with this Quine of yours. His method of acquiring hypotheses about words, signalling assent or dissent, is a shambles. And his notion of stimulus meaning is clouded by categories he didn't have any intention of including. But on the other hand, I couldn't resist saying, using his method has unearthed interesting questions, such as that of the connection between the purpose of pictures and the size of their compliance class. Another question is that of the stimulus analyticity of pictures. Are there pictures that will elicit an affirmative response in the presence of any stimulus? I suspect not, but proving this might be a very interesting task. And the unintended inclusion of metaphors and abstract paintings in the class of symbols having a stimulus meaning need not be regarded as a flaw. After all, it seems that Quine's theory may proceed beyond the mere comma pushing and flirting with the sciences that you accused it of not half an hour ago. You have a point, I admit, said the gentleman with the moustache. And what's more, I said, are applying this almost Cartesian method of doubting to pictorial representation has proved this much at least. Whereas pictures seem much more readily accessible than language, they do not nearly as often have a stimulus meaning as words do. This I would consider a proof of the rule that language has a primacy over pictures in the understanding of foreign cultures, a rule that will hold for any heuristic system, be it analytic or no. And our bespectacled colleague couldn't resist adding, and the principle of charity stands as strong as ever.